Chapter 3, Lodge 341, Vermissa. On the day following the evening which had contained so many exciting events, McMurdo moved his lodgings from old Jacob Shafter's and took up his quarters at the widow McNamara's on the extreme outskirts of the town. Scanlon, his original acquaintance aboard the train, had occasion shortly afterwards to move into Vermissa, and the two lodged together. There was no other boarder, and the hostess was an easy-going old Irish woman who left them to themselves, so that they had a freedom for speech and action welcome to men who had secrets in common. Shafter had relented to the extent of letting McMurdo come to his meals there when he liked, so that his intercourse with Etty was by no means broken. On the contrary, it drew closer and more intimate as the weeks went by. In his bedroom at his new abode, McMurdo felt it safe to take out the coining mould, and under many a pledge of secrecy, a number of brothers from the lodge were allowed to come in and see them, each carrying away in his pocket some examples of the false money, so cunningly struck that there was never the slightest difficulty or danger in passing it. Why, with such a wonderful art at his command, McMurdo should condescend to work at all was a perpetual mystery to his companions, though he made it clear to anyone who asked him that if he lived without any visible means, it would very quickly bring the police upon his track. One policeman was indeed after him already, but the incident, as luck would have it, did the adventurer a great deal more good than harm. After the first introduction, there were few evenings when he did not find his way to McGinty's saloon, there to make closer acquaintance with the boys, which was the jovial title by which the dangerous gang who infested the place were known to one another. His dashing manner and fearlessness of speech made him a favourite with them all, while the rapid and scientific way in which he polished off his antagonist in an all-in barroom scrap earned the respect of that rough community. Another incident, however, raised him even higher in their estimation. Just at the crowded hour one night, the door opened and a man entered with a quiet blue uniform and peaked cap of the mine police. This was a special body raised by the railways and colliery owners to supplement the efforts of the ordinary civil police, who were perfectly helpless in the face of the organized ruffianism which terrorized the district. There was a hush as he entered, and many a curious glance was cast at him. But the relations between policemen and criminals are peculiar in some parts of the States, and McGinty himself, standing behind his counter, showed no surprise when the policeman enrolled himself among his customers.
Straight whiskey, for the night is bitter, said the police officer. I don't think we have met before, Counselor.
You'll be the new captain, said McGinty.
That's so. We are looking to you, Counselor, and to the other leading citizens, to help us in upholding law and order in this township. Captain Marvin is my name.
We'd do better without you, Captain Marvin, said McGinty coldly, for we have our own police of the township, and no need for any imported goods. What are you but the paid tool of the capitalists, hired by them to club or shoot your poor old fellow citizen?
Well, well, we won't argue about that, said the police officer good-humouredly. I expect we all do our duty same as we see it, but we can't all see it the same. He had drunk off his glass and had turned to go, when his eyes fell upon the face of Jack McMurdo, who was scowling at his elbow.
"Hello, hello," he cried, looking him up and down. "Here's an old acquaintance."
McMurdo shrank away from him.
"I was never a friend to you nor any other cursed copper in my life," said he.
"An acquaintance isn't always a friend," said the police captain, grinning. "You're Jack McMurdo of Chicago, right enough, and don't you deny it."
McMurdo shrugged his shoulders. "I'm not denying it," said he. "Do you think I'm ashamed of my own name? You've got good cause to be, anyhow."
"What the devil do you mean by that?" he roared with his fists clenched. "No, no, Jack, bluster won't do with me. I was an officer in Chicago before ever I came to this darned coal bunker, and I know a Chicago crook when I see one."
McMurdo's face fell.
"Don't tell me that you're Marvin of the Chicago Central," he cried. "Just the same old Teddy Marvin at your service. We haven't forgotten the shooting of Jonas Pinto up there."
"I never shot him."
"Did you not?
That's good impartial evidence, ain't it? Well, his death came in uncommon handy for you, or they would have had you for shoving the queer. Well, we can let that be bygones, for, between you and me, and perhaps I'm going further than my duty in saying it, they could get no clear case against you, and Chicago's open to you tomorrow. I'm very well where I am. Well, I've given you the pointer, and you're a sulky dog not to thank me for it.
Well, I suppose you mean well, and I do thank you, said McMurdo, in no very gracious manner.
It's mum with me, so long as I see you living on the straight, said the captain. But, by the Lord, if you get off after this, it's another story. So, good night to you, and good night, counsellor.
He left the barroom, but not before he had created a local hero. McMurdo's deeds in far Chicago had been whispered before. He had put off all questions with a smile, as one who did not wish to have greatness thrust upon him. But now the thing was officially confirmed. The bar loafers crowded round him and shook him heartily by the hand. He was free of the community from that time on. He could drink hard and show little trace of it, but that evening, had his mate Scanlon not been at hand to lead him home, the fated hero would surely have spent his night under the bar. On a Saturday night, McMurdo was introduced to the lodge. He had thought to pass in without ceremony as being an initiate of Chicago. But there were particular rites in Vermissa of which they were proud, and these had to be undergone by every postulant. The assembly met in a larger room reserved for such purposes at the Union House. Some 60 members assembled at Vermissa, but that by no means represented the full strength of the organization, for there were several other lodges in the valley, and others across the mountains on each side, who exchanged members when any serious business was afoot, so that the crime might be done by men who were strangers to the locality. Altogether, there were not less than 500 scattered over the coal district. In the bare assembly room, the men were gathered round a long table. At the side was a second one, laden with bottles and glasses, on which some members of the company were already turning their eyes. McGinty sat at the head with a flat black velvet cap upon his shock of tangled black hair and a coloured purple stole round his neck, so that he seemed to be a priest presiding over some diabolical ritual. To right and left of him were the higher lodge officials, the cruel, handsome face of Ted Baldwin among them. Each of these wore some scarf or medallion as emblem of his office. They were, for the most part, men of mature age, but the rest of the company consisted of young fellows from 18 to 25, the ready and capable agents who carried out the commands of their seniors. Among the older men were many whose features showed the tigerish, lawless souls within. But looking at the rank and file, it was difficult to believe that these eager and open-faced young fellows were in very truth a dangerous gang of murderers, whose minds had suffered such complete moral perversion that they took a horrible pride in their proficiency at the business, and looked with deepest respect at the man who had the reputation of making what they called a clean job. To their contorted natures, it had become a spirited and chivalrous thing to volunteer for service against some man who had never injured them, and whom, in many cases, they had never seen in their lives. The crime committed, they quarrelled as to who had actually struck the fatal blow, and amused one another and the company by describing the cries and contortions of the murdered man. At first, they had shown some secrecy in their arrangements, but at the time which this narrative describes, their proceedings were extraordinarily open, for the repeated failure of the law had proved to them that, on the one hand, no one would dare to witness against them, and on the other, they had an unlimited number of staunch witnesses upon whom they could call, and a well-filled treasure chest from which they could draw the funds to engage the best legal talent in the state. In 10 long years of outrage there had been no single conviction, and the only danger that ever threatened the Scourers lay in the victim himself, who, however outnumbered and taken by surprise, might and occasionally did leave his mark upon his assailants.